Support made possible by Strategic Farm Marketing. Strategic's annual series of crop insurance and grain marketing meetings are currently underway across the Midwest. Go to www.sfarmmarketing.com. to register for a meeting near you.
From the land of Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 21st day of January 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson at L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana. Don Day should join us from Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, to take a look at the forecast for the Midwest and the growing regions across the planet. And I'll update you on a new easement rule that NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, is on the Federal Register right now for comment and what it might mean to working lands across the United States and how they could be taken out of production voluntarily. And we'll do that right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago today, corn futures are down about a penny and three quarters. The March at 387.5, December of next year at 401.5. Soybeans were down 13 and three quarters in the lead at 916. Next year's November, 9.25 lower at 951.25. Wheat futures up a dime for the day. They finished at 580.5 for the soft red. Live cattle futures in Chicago were 2.5 higher. Feeders were down 27.5 cents and lean hogs 32.5 cents. Laura Wayne Nelson at L&M Commodities in Newmarket, Indiana, now joins us to take a look at the marketplace. Hey, Wayne, tell me what happened in the beans.
Well, I think there was a couple of things, Todd. Of course, the bean export sales were okay. Not like the corn was lower, but I think that our coronavirus killed six. A lot of worries about what's happening with that in the world and how what they're going to do as far as what in China and looking ahead. We also have the problem that I think that a lot of our traders thought that as soon as we signed this thing, they were going to come running in here and buy gobs of beans and corn and everything. And basically, that isn't really what's going to happen. They're going to buy it over the year. And we'll look at the possibility of why would you not buy from Brazil in the middle of their harvest when it's cheaper there and then come back to us when they start going into storage. But a lot of anticipation by some of the funds, and they were heavy sellers again today.
Yeah, Secretary Perdue trying to make sure that the trade and farmers both at AFBF yesterday understood that he believed the Chinese would be in earlier rather than later. But as you discuss, the marketplace looks and says, wait a second, are the Chinese actually going to be here or will they wait until the fall, which is their normal buying time, I suppose. What are you looking forward to the rest of this week to hear about?
Well, I think that, we seem to sort of found a little bit of a bottom, I think, in the corn for here right now. I think that, the open interest was down 32,000 contracts on Friday. When they come back in and bought the contracts they sold on Thursday. And I think we're sort of seeing things with the beans down as hard as they were, corn laying down 1.5 to 2. That wasn't too bad of a sell-off there. We are looking at the weather forecast in South America. The 16 to 30-day forecast does have 2/3 eastern Argentina and the southern 1/4 of Brazil dry out there like that. We're reading one other guy that his wife is on a tour in South America, and there was 18 combines lined up sitting there saying, wait until the rain stops. So that is holding up the harvest in Brazil in many areas. And if we can hold it up a week or so, why, that's another week that it's a little later planting the safrinha crop and might be a little bit helpful to us. But all in all, I think it's more of a sideways trade here the rest of the week, the way the funds are looking at things.
The trades had some time to think about what the Chinese deal might mean to the next or February WASD report. Those numbers will be built in some form. But, of course, it's always an addition and a subtraction. You might add Chinese exports, but subtract something from some other place. Has there been much discussion about this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the big headlines was in two or three of the different things we read today said they're all waiting to see how WASD is going to incorporate the Phase 1 into the February 11th report, none of us knowing how. The other thing we're looking at is wheat seems to be the one thing that's holding up. The Russian wheat hit a marketing year high here this week, and the Egyptian demand, is continuing to stay strong and keeping the wheat market looking good. And, of course, we didn't get much wheat planted in the U.S., and it's not looking too good what's out there. And, of course, Australia just keeps burning up, so it does help a little bit that way. So that's a little bit what we're looking at in that regards.
And thanks, Wayne. Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of Newmarket, Indiana.
Support for WILO comes from Risk Management Commodities, sponsor of the Winter Outlook Lunch Meeting on Thursday, January 30th at Hog Heaven Barbecue, Mount Carmel, Illinois, 11 o'clock Central Standard Time. Register at 866-837-9027 or email Kelly at riskcom.biz.
Let's turn our attention now to the weather forecast. Don Day is here from Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hey, Don, thanks so much for being with us. Tell me about the weather forecast across the Midwest.
The Midwest is about ready to head into another winter storm as we get into late Wednesday night, Thursday, and Friday. We're going to see snow again, likely heavy, across portions of northern, northwest Missouri, southeastern areas of Nebraska, a large swath of Iowa, into Wisconsin, northern Illinois, and into the northern Great Lakes, parts of Minnesota as well in the south. Snow line will probably make it into central and northern areas of Indiana and Illinois. Likely going to be more of a rain-snow mix and more wet for central southern Illinois, central southern Indiana, and Ohio. Those areas could see as much as an inch or more of moisture out of this storm system, and this storm system will then head into New England by the weekend, causing winter weather there. So for the second week in a row, another Midwestern snow event is coming our way. We're hoping there won't be as much wind and blizzard conditions with this system as the last one. This will be more of a heavy, wet snowfall. Now let's head south of the equator and head into South America first. There's going to be some rain, some pretty good rain over some of the key growing areas of central and southeastern areas of Brazil. Far southern and southwest Brazil will have spotty rain, but a little bit below average. The best rain in Argentina will be in the central and northern growing areas. A little bit drier in the southern areas of Argentina. Temperatures in South America, the key growing areas of Brazil and Argentina, looking at near average temperatures, nothing too hot or too cold. In fire-stricken Australia, they've had rain and they've had some thunderstorms. Yes, there's been some severe weather, but that severe weather has brought rain to New South Wales and other areas of eastern Australia. And over the next week to 10 days, those far eastern areas of Australia, especially the north and northeast, will have the best chances for rain. That does include some of the fire areas, along with temperatures that aren't going to be as warm. So the problems in Australia are far from over, but the weather patterns have become more favorable for precipitation and temperatures that won't be quite as hot.
Thanks, Don. Don Day is with Day Weather from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Each Tuesday at this time, we take a look at the agricultural energy market. Dave Chatterton is here from Strategic Farm Marketing right here in Champaign County, Illinois. Thanks for being with us, Dave. Where would you like to start today?
Well, it's been a tumultuous little period here since we talked last, Todd. We've had a lot of geopolitics and political premium going into and out of this market and risk premium going into and out of it. The market's actually topped out in early December. You know, with the assassination of the Iranian general by the U.S. drone, we had a big run in the market. And then since then, it's been almost straight down. We've only had one update since that December 8th high for in the heating oil and in the markets that are important to us. So it's been a very volatile time period. But with the trade deal getting done and with the, I guess, the military intervention behind us here, we're still faced with some rather burdensome supply and demand issues. And we've seen, for in the case of diesel fuel or heating oil, we've seen the market fall from a high of around 212 in futures to down around 184 today. And that matches pretty much where we were in the fall low. The summer lows that we had in that heating oil were 175 to 185. So it's definitely an area where you want to be paying attention to your diesel fuel needs. If we go all the way back to January of this of last year, our low was 165 on those futures contracts. And that was actually the low for both 2019 and 2018. So we're approaching some pretty key areas of support here and something to be paying attention to.
Does this mean all the primary players, the United States, Russia, OPEC, are all pumping as fast as they can?
Well, in the terms of the U.S. and Russia, I think the answer is yes, and particularly for the U.S. We continue to set new records for crude oil production and exports of both crude oil and refined products going out of the U.S. The U.S.-China deal opens the door, just like it does in grains, to even greater exports of those energy products. It probably doesn't change the global supply-demand balance much. It doesn't create new demand, but it certainly can shift market share to the U.S. It was very interesting today to see the market reaction. We had Libyan oil go on force majeure. They had some political strife, shut down their terminals. They typically pump around 1.2 million barrels a day, and the market actually trades lower on the day on that news. And I think that's due to the OPEC supply cuts, Todd. And they've been struggling to stay in compliance with those They have about 3 million barrels per day of excess production capacity, and so the market takes it as a situation where there's just not a lot of supply disruptions that are going to bother this market outside of something we get in the Gulf or something on the military front going forward.
Is this putting pressure on the ethanol industry?
It is, I think, on two fronts. Certainly, we saw that when the waivers came out, there are now more waivers, you know, being applied for on the list, and that continues to be problematic. These cheaper prices for gasoline are certainly not welcomed in the ethanol circles and certainly put some pressure on margins. And as we look forward, we continue to see a degradation of U.S. gasoline demand as a whole, and that's a function of a number of different things. It's demographics, it's fuel efficiency standards, it's electric vehicles. It's, you know, a number of different things working on that, but reversing that trend seems like a very tough sell going forward. So a bigger problem longer term for both ethanol and corn is going to be how we replace that demand and can we find an export outlet for these products.
Something more directly farmer-related, propane had been hard to get as it was needed to dry down a corn crop that was awfully wet. Has that subsided and are propane supplies available now?
Yeah, Todd, it's been a tough winter for propane, particularly for the grain drying industry, and we've gotten past the worst of it. Prices are on their way down. We peaked out those markets, you know, from a wholesale basis and on the farm back probably in late November and through the month of December, and we've fallen really, you know, propane from a wholesale level Midwest topped out around 55, 58 cents. We're back down to around 38 or 39 cents. So we've had a nice comeback, and we're actually seeing supply come back in. The crude oil production that we have in the U.S. is forcing additional supply into the channels, and it looks like we could see prices continue to be under pressure. Be aware, though, that we're at 39 cents versus a market today. Looking forward into your, you know, what you may need for summer irrigation for fall drying, as we approach that 30-cent area, that's a multiple-year low. We haven't really been below that area or touched that area since back in 08, and we really haven't been below it since back into the early 2000s. So it's a number that on paper seems like it's nearing the cost of production and maybe something to be paying attention to as you go forward here. So don't be afraid to look at those forward values and to maybe top your tank off here at some point this spring or summer.
Hey, thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Todd.
Dave Chatterton is with Strategic Farm Marketing, helped us take a look at the agricultural energy sector on this Tuesday afternoon. The Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, has published a new set of easement rules to the Federal Register. They're open for comment through the 6th day of March. Paula Hinkson is with NRCS, and I hope that she can help explain just exactly what these rules are and how they'll work. Thanks for being with us, Paula. Can you tell me about the rules, please?
Yes. So you're correct. We do have a new rule for the easement program. Now that we have the new Farm Bill, that's a year old, it takes a little bit to get the rules in place. But so what it does is it takes any changes from the 2018 Farm Bill and it rolls it into a new rule with the changes that the Congress folks would like to see. And that rule then gets published, which is where we are currently. We've published that rule. It's considered an interim rule, and it gives the public 60 days to read the rule and make any comments on things that they like about the easement program, things that they don't like about the easement program, and it gives them the opportunity to provide input into the rule that has been created as a result of the new Farm Bill.
This is for landowners.
Yes.
What's an easement, and what does it have to do with NRCS and conservation in this case?
Okay, those are all good questions. So an easement is the federal government actually purchasing an easement on a piece of property that the landowner continues to own. And we offer two different kinds of easements. One is an easement that we purchase and the land gets converted into a wetland restoration type of property. The other one is an ag land easement where we purchase an easement on the property, the landowner continues to own it, and it stays in crop production or ag production if you wanted to convert it to grazing. That's an opportunity too. So what this does is it gives the federal government the opportunity to help protect land and still allow the landowner to be the owner of the property.
So when you do an easement like that and it's in ag production, is the federal government requiring what at that point from the producer or the landowner?
So if we're purchasing a wetland easement, what we're actually purchasing are all the rights from the landowner to crop it. We're requiring the land to be converted to a wetland restoration. And the rights that the landowner keeps are the right to own it and sell it, the right to enjoy it, quiet enjoyment is what we say, the right to hunt it, but most of the rest of the rights we purchase in order to have a wetland restoration site, which, what does that do for conservation? The wetland restoration provides places for the migratory waterfowl to stop as they're migrating from south to north, north to south, a place for them to feed, get re-energized, and then finish their migration. And it also provides a place for runoff water to come through these wetland locations and reduce the amount of pesticides, soil erosion that might get into the water. So it's an opportunity to clean up the waters of the United States.
In this case, let's for instance say I'm the landowner, I want to do this easement. The rights that I give up, is it still private property, or can the government open this up for the public?
That's a really good question. It is still private property, which is the best part of the program. So the landowner, in fact, is still responsible for any trespassing, any kind of dumping or anything that might happen to the property. So it's definitely still their property, and they control the access to the property. The only thing they have to do is to let us on the property just to see how things are going, monitor the property, and we stay in close contact with the landowner so they know when we're out there. But as far as letting the public come out there, absolutely not, only unless they want to, but they definitely do not have to.
Who pays to create and maintain the wetland? And is it a constructed wetland event, or is it just the purchase of an easement of an existing, what would be regarded as a wetland?
Also a good question. What we do is we try to convert the acreage back to what it was historically. So if before it was being cropped, it was a wet timber area, then that's what we try to convert it back to. If it's an area where there was a lot of water, then we do some constructing of a berm and try to hold some water back. We also try to work with the landowner to see what would they like to see in that area and try to create something that fits their needs. Since they're going to continue to own it, maybe they want part of an area to have some standing water in it. So we work with the landowner on that, as well as the ultimate goal is to convert it back to what it used to be historically.
Is the landowner responsible for maintenance cost and construction, or is it offset?
Yeah, the federal government pays 100% for the construction or planting trees, whatever that restoration cost would be. So the landowner is responsible for keeping the noxious weeds and invasive weeds out of the site. In terms of management, if they wanted to manage the site to maybe raise and lower the water levels, things like that, they can do that, and we can help pay for some of those things depending on how much money we have available. But the maintenance part of the landowner's responsibility is generally not expensive, since we pay a certain amount of money per acre when we purchase the easement, and then we also pay for the restoration cost. So the landowner's investment is very, in the very beginning, it's nothing, and then over time, it's going to be very minimal.
So the easement payment is a one-time payment up front. It's not an annual rental or a lease agreement.
Right. It is a one-time payment. You can spread those payments over a series of years if that works better for the landowner, but it is not an annual rental payment, which a lot of landowners are used to through the Conservation Reserve Program.
What's the duration of the easements?
So we have two different options for easements. We can allow people to put an easement on the property for 30 years, or they can put it on permanently, which means if they ever sell the property, the easement is recorded at the courthouse. It's a part of the property deed. And when the land sells, the new owner takes over that same wetland restoration easement. So the easement, the ones that are permanent, stay with the property forever.
Tell me about the easements that go along with actual ag production. What would happen there?
So those are very interesting, actually. We have quite a few of those up around the Chicago area, particularly in Kane County, and we also have one in McHenry County. Those easements allow crop production to continue and to avoid any conversion to a city, or, you know, where they have the urban land encroachment. This easement allows the land to stay in cropland forever. Those are permanent easements as well. These have been very interesting for people that have maybe been third and fourth generation of farmers, and maybe they're concerned that what will happen to the farm when I pass away. They're able to put these into a conservation easement and then feel comfortable that this is going to stay cropland. And usually we're putting them on prime farmland acres, so we're putting them on nice flat acres that are good cropland places, and we're making areas that cannot be converted to any type of an urban setting. They can convert them from row crops to grazing land if they would like. And we do have a few easements that are on some more rolling topography, which is actually a good thing, too. If you're close to an urban area, it kind of provides some green space. So very interesting how people have been interested in these easements just to ensure that the land stays in ag production.
So tell me about the potential changes to these programs. ACEP, I assume that's the way you pronounce it, and what that actually stands for.
Yeah, ACEP is the way you pronounce it. It is ACEP, and that stands for Agricultural Conservation Easement Program. And then within that, as we have talked, there's the ag land easement, and then there's also the wetland reserve easements. But as far as some of the highlights of the changes that are particularly of interest to people in this new iteration as a result of the new Farm Bill, they're authorizing assistance to partners who pursue buy, protect, sell transactions. They're requiring a conservation plan for highly erodible land that will be protected by ag land easements. They're increasing the flexibility for partners to meet cost share matching requirements, and that's particularly on the ag land easements, those three things. Then some changes for the wetland reserve easements are identifying water quality as a program purpose for enrollment of wetland reserve easements. In the past, it's maybe been a little bit more geared toward migratory waterfowl. Now they're also looking at the benefits of the water quality of these wetland reserve easements, and then expanding the wetland types eligible for restoration and management under wetland restoration easements. So as I mentioned before, historically we've been looking at putting that property back to what it was years ago, and now they're giving the opportunity to maybe not necessarily put it back to what it was historically, and maybe looking at other options in some situations where maybe another option fits better.
Hey, Paula, thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Paula Hinksman is with NRCS, and we've been talking about a new easement rule as it relates to agricultural land, properties that might be put into wetlands as well, that's been published in the Federal Register. If you'd like to make comments on the rule or see it in full, you can do that through the 6th day of March. Look this up at regulations.gov. You're going to be under the docket 2019-0006. Again, that's NRCS-2019-0006 under the Federal Register at regulations.gov. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.